Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision. Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor, read by Melissa Bonnet. This is being recorded on November 5th, 2025. Today, I will be reading from the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, followed by articles under the topic of commentary and the region of Asia Pacific. We start with the article, End of the Rainbow. 30 years after it scrapped racial segregation, South Africa seeks to recover a founding story that inspired the world. There are several photos with the captions, People Sing and Dance, at a concert commemorating the life of Nelson Mandela in Cape Town, December 11, 2013. And Archbishop Desmond Tutu and his wife, Leah, dance in Soweto after hearing Mr. Mandela would be released from prison in 1990. By Terence McNamee. Terence McNamee is a senior fellow at the Montreal Institute for Global Security, a writer and consultant specializing in geopolitics. He divides time between Canada and South Africa. This story is from Johannesburg. Every nation needs a story. Most nations are accidents of history, different groups of people thrown together by circumstance. Occupying the same territory, their lives and futures are linked. Founding stories, myths, help stitch them together by transmitting shared values and hopes. Without these stories, nations struggle to make sense of themselves. The best stories have an enormous capacity to persuade and influence. They are never entirely rational. Origin myths, in particular, oversimplify history and mask contradictions. But if they are unique and compelling, evoke our deepest emotions, and even reveal something of the sacred, their power is almost limitless. No country ended the previous century with a better story than South Africa. Its perilous leap from a racial oligarchy to a non-racial democracy in the 1990s captivated the world's imagination. Archbishop Desmond Tutu famously described the new country that came into being as the, quote, rainbow nation, end quote. United under the figure of Nelson Mandela, the country's first freely elected president and leader of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, party, South Africa became a beacon for societies grappling with tensions and divisions. Its international clout soared. Sometime in the 2000s, this changed. Growing factionalism within the ANC put nation building on the back burner. Politics became consumed by ideological clashes and scheming over state resources. Some of Mr. Mandela's successors became disillusioned with the founding story. Others neglected it, or even undermined it. Few saw it as especially useful in their bid for power. Soon, the story became buried in the avalanche of corruption and misrule that followed. Today, South Africa is rudderless at home. According to an Ipsos, quote, What Worries the World, end quote, study released in September, 8 in 10 South Africans believe the country is headed in the wrong direction. Serious analysts have labeled South Africa a, quote, mafia state, end quote. Water and energy infrastructure in Johannesburg, the country's and the continent's financial hub, is crumbling. The city's politics have become farcical. 9 mayors in the past 6 years. Turmoil at home has eroded South Africa's standing abroad, not least across Africa, where it was once viewed as the, quote, natural leader, end quote, owing to its economic might and exemplary democratic transition. The founding vision that human rights would be the light that guided South African foreign policy dimmed as ANC officials kowtowed to more and more repressive regimes. Their much-praised case against Israel at the International Court of Justice does not affirm South Africa's moral stature, inasmuch as it highlights how selective their condemnation of injustices worldwide has become. As the world's spotlight turns on South Africa as host of the upcoming Group of 20 Nations Summit, its government is attempting to repair the country's battered reputation, fix its broken economy, and restore public trust. But these efforts are unlikely to succeed unless tethered to the same unifying vision that helped South Africa avoid the abyss in the early 1990s. In June of this year, South Africa's president and ANC leader, Cyril Ramaphosa, announced the establishment of the National Dialogue. It was billed as the most important conversation on the future of the nation since the end of apartheid. It would be, Mr. Ramaphosa declared, a historic opportunity for South Africans, quote, from all walks of life to come together, to reflect on the state of our country, end quote. The National Dialogue's opening convention in August was a chance to show the world its best face. Instead, it exposed the country's broken heart. Key civil society organizations withdrew from the event, citing ANC efforts to control the agenda. No other major political party participated. Mr. Ramaphosa's intent was laudable, but his call to, quote, reimagine, end quote, the country's future, was misplaced. South Africans don't need a new story. They need to know why the best one they will ever have was squandered. South Africa's transition was a triumph of the liberal international order created in the aftermath of World War II, with the ideology of promoting democracy worldwide and expanding prosperity. In meaning and impact, only the collapse of the Berlin Wall was comparable. The Rainbow Nation seemed to affirm the central tenet of the West. The arc of history was turning away from autocracy toward freedom and inclusivity. That post-war order is beginning to fragment. It might already be dead. It is against this backdrop that a battle for the soul of South Africa is being waged. The current crop of leaders in South Africa came of age when the country weighed more heavily on the world's conscience than any other nation. No policy of any state provoked more condemnation from the international community than apartheid, the system of racial segregation that deprived the country's black majority of equal opportunities and services during the latter part of the 20th century. The black uprising in South Africa's townships was the global media event of the 1980s. The political transformation that followed was so swift and improbable that even sober analysts dubbed it a, quote, miracle, end quote. Two men were at the heart of it. One was white, E.W. de Klerk, who spent his career upholding apartheid, which dehumanized millions of people. The other was black, Mr. Mandela, who spent 27 years in prison for opposing it. In 1993, they were jointly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Through gritted teeth, they and their respective negotiators forged mutual trust and made parlous compromises that helped steer the country away from a violent catastrophe. In the end, white people would relinquish political control to the black majority in return for retaining most of their pre-existing economic power. What was achieved collectively in the 1990s during a period of immense fear and uncertainty became South Africa's greatest export. The country's new multicolored flag and new multilingual anthem ignited imaginations everywhere with the possibility that no societal divides were unbridgeable. Mr. Mandela's inauguration in 1994 bore testimony to this fact. It was the largest gathering of world leaders in 50 years. The work of nation building continued with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which investigated widespread human rights violations during the apartheid era and sought to promote rapprochement. The TRC set a global precedent for dealing with complex legacies of mass violence and systemic injustice, influencing many such commissions worldwide. The adoption of its new constitution, rooted in the non-racial vision of South African society, first set out in the 1955 Multi-Party Freedom Charter, was another key milestone. It was lauded globally as one of the most progressive ever written. In a speech in 1996, Deputy President Thabo Mbeki hailed the Constitution as, quote, an unequivocal statement that we refuse to accept that our Africanness shall be defined by our race, color, gender, or historical origins. It is a firm assertion made by ourselves that South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white. End quote. His, quote, I am an African, end quote, speech stirred a sense of belonging and common purpose. It was, quote, a time of almost limitless hope and possibility, recalls Palesa Marudu, a Washington, D.C.-based writer and former activist who grew up in a township outside Pretoria. No longer teetering on the edge, quote, South Africa was bursting with creativity across all spheres of society, including music, fashion, the arts. Mr. Mbeki's speech was a crystallization of that confident new nation looking into the future. End quote. The Rainbow Nation narrative was crafted and driven by the country's elite, but it drew in the whole of society, offering hope and dignity after decades of systematic oppression. Political analyst Lukona Manugi remembers his small town of Flagstaff in the Eastern Cape province as, quote, a buzz with excitement, end quote, after 1994. However abstract and aspirational the Rainbow Nation might have been in his remote rural community, he recalls that, quote, everyone had buy-in, end quote, and wanted to participate in this story. South Africa's hard-earned moral authority enabled it to recover from its political and economic isolation. Tackling its profound structural challenges would take time. Wealth remained overwhelmingly concentrated within the white population. Vast inequalities persisted. Diplomatic gains were more immediate and pronounced. Under Mr. Mandela, South Africa built up an enormous reserve political capital, promoting the transition story to enhance its role around the globe. In 1999, it became a founding member of and the only African country within the G20, which comprises the world's largest economies. Excuse me. The new government also leveraged in its diplomacy the dismantlement of the apartheid regime's secret nuclear weapons arsenal, portraying itself as an exemplary convert to the non-nuclear club. After years as one of the world's worst offenders, South Africa became a leading voice on non-proliferation and was instrumental in the successful continent-wide negotiations on declaring Africa a nuclear weapons-free zone. There's a photo next to this that shows South African student protesters in Soweto use cars as roadblocks during unrest in 1976. President-elect Nelson Mandela stands with President F.W. de Klerk and Deputy President-elect Thabo Mbeki as they listen to the country's, at the time, two national anthems outside Parliament in Cape Town, South Africa, in 1994. By the time Mr. Mandela left office in 1999 and was replaced by his deputy, Mr. Mbeki, South Africa's founding story had proved its worth in advancing reconciliation and rewiring the state. Quote, every country has an underlying story about the why of its existence, and that legitimizes its social and political contract, end quote. Martin Kimani, CEO of the Africa Center and formerly Kenya's ambassador to the United Nations, explains, quote, in this regard, the psychic, political, and financial value of the South African story was simply incalculable, end quote. Mr. Mandela knew better than anyone that the work had only just begun. Quote, rainbowism, end quote, was not a panacea for resolving the deep-rooted legacies of apartheid. But powerful myths and images could shift mindsets, enabling substantive reforms. Quote, appearances constitute reality, Mr. Mandela once told Richard Stengel, the ghostwriter of his book, Long Walk to Freedom. There's another photograph. Noli Mohapi, the first witness before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, is sworn in at the first hearing in 1996. The chair of the commission, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, sits in the center of the panel. In 1998, U.S. President Bill Clinton and Nelson Mandela peer through the bars of Mandela's former prison cell on Robben Island, where he had been jailed for 18 of the 27 total years he was incarcerated. Under Mr. Mbeki's watch, the rhetoric gradually shifted from idealistic unity to a recognition that old fault lines were beginning to widen again. Gross inequalities could turn the rainbow nation into, quote, two nations, end quote, warned Mr. Mbeki. Quote, one black and poor, one white and well off, end quote. After Mr. Mbeki, Jacob Zuma, president from 2009 to 2018, positioned himself as a defender of marginalized black people and fanned historical grievances, mostly as cover for his administration and cronies to steal huge sums of public funds. Mr. Zuma and his core supporters viewed the founding story as an obstacle in their way. Most of the ANC went along with him. Predictably, the economy tanked. The story of South Africa began to be contested. Within months of Mr. Mandela's passing, his legacy was being reappraised by younger black iconoclasts and graduates with little prospect of finding work. They were joined by ANC breakaway groups, such as the Economic Freedom Fighters. Their version of the negotiated settlement with the white regime framed it as a defeat, courtesy of black sellouts. When Mr. Ramaphosa came to power in 2018, a wave of optimism swept the country. As a favorite of Mr. Mandela and chief negotiator for the ANC during the transition, he had been a pivotal figure in discussions with the apartheid regime. Yet, since becoming president, he hasn't championed the Rainbow Nation narrative either. Opinions vary on why the story became toxic in the ANC. Quote, "The Rainbow Nation was always an illusion, a phantasm that could never be sustained," ventured Stuart Doran, an Australian historian who has written extensively about neighboring Zimbabwe's descent into autocracy. Quote, "Today's South Africa leaves a lingering sense that most of the lauded artifacts of the transition were faux, not real. They continue to be lionized by those who don't live by them, and they are scorned by those who see no need for the pretense." End quote. It can be costly for black leaders to trumpet the Rainbow Nation story. White business, which played its own part in the corruption that made South Africans lose faith in the direction of the country, still holds most of the key economic levers. Quote, "Most people intuitively know that we also need white South Africans to participate in developing the country," explains Kuben Naidu, a former South African Reserve Bank deputy governor whose family was close to the Mandelas. Quote, "The problem is that saying this too loudly reinforces a narrative that whites are superior and without them, blacks can't succeed, which is an unhelpful stereotype in resolving South Africa's deep disparities," he says. Prior to 2024, the ANC had won thumping majorities in every national election since apartheid ended, when the party lost its majority for the first time last year, falling to 40% of the vote. The country was on tenterhooks. Many doubted that the ANC would accept the result, let alone strike an agreement with its fiercest political foe, the white-led opposition party, the Democratic Alliance. By them putting aside their mutual antipathy for the good of the country, the new government of national unity, they appeared to breathe new life into the wilting spirit of 1994. It didn't last. Unlike in 1994, there was no story to fortify the idea of national unity. Today, both parties portray it as a pragmatic necessity to ensure stable governance, nothing more. They remain openly contemptuous of one another. In the days before Mr. Ramaphosa's much-anticipated Oval Office date with U.S. President Donald Trump in May, the South African media framed the meeting as a chance to lift the public mood, a chance to reset the country's image, not just in the eyes of Washington, but in those of the world. But when Mr. Ramaphosa was ambushed with, quote, "evidence," end quote, of a, quote, "white genocide," end quote, he knew to be bogus. Pictures of thousands of crosses, each supposedly marking the systematic killing of a farmer, he failed to push back. President Trump was taking dead aim at South Africa's founding ideals of reconciliation and non-racialism. Mr. Ramaphosa could have defended them, even while accepting that his country has a severe crime problem. Their photographs with the captions, "Former South African President Jacob Zuma, accused of corruption, consults with his legal team at the High Court in Pietermaritzburg, South Africa, in 2022. And residents walk down paths between informal dwellings known as shanties in Diepsloot, South Africa, in 2013. And people chat as they have their cars washed at the Moja Car Wash in Soweto Township in Johannesburg in 2017. The danger in not telling your own story is, of course, that someone else will. This helps explain the surge of revanchism in South Africa. Quote, "Nature abhors a vacuum," warns Lerato Ngobeni, national spokesperson for Action SA, an opposition party in parliament. Quote, If the Rainbow Nation ideal is no longer being articulated, or worse, is viewed cynically as empty symbolism, in its place we see competing, often exclusionary, narratives gaining ground. End quote. In the Western Cape, South Africa's best-run province, according to Ratings Africa, an independent governance assessment organization, polling by independence activists suggests that more than half of the population wants a referendum on secession. Nationally, two populist ethnicity-based parties, the Patriotic Alliance and the Zulu Nationalist MK Party, led by former President Zuma, collectively won about 16.5% of the vote in 2024, despite never having any previous success. The Black Nationalist and Communist Party Economic Freedom Fighters, which won around 10%, along with the MK Party and a chunk of the ANC, wants to nationalize the economy and redistribute white-owned land. The challenge to South Africa's founding story that has attracted the most attention this year comes from the Afrikaners, descendants of mainly Dutch settlers who conceived apartheid, make up roughly 4% of South Africa's total population. A well-organized and outspoken minority of Afrikaners now cast themselves as victims of the democratic dispensation. They want to litigate the 1994 deal and win special rights. Quote, "The end game is freedom." End quote. The Afrikaner nationalists' most recognized leader globally, Ernst Roetz, wrote recently on the social platform X, quote, "Freedom for the Afrikaner people, but also freedom for other communities," end quote. The Trump administration's focus on the Afrikaner community's, quote, plight, end quote, shot to prominence globally when dozens arrived in the United States as refugees in May. Exactly why the Trump administration has so readily embraced their cause is much debated. Some put it down to the U.S. culture wars. The supposed victimization of white people in South Africa plays seamlessly into narratives that are gaining ground on American soil. Others cite the influence of key figures close to the administration who grew up in the country, such as Elon Musk, who have convinced Mr. Trump that Pretoria's race-based policies only perpetuate crime and corruption. Whichever, it's clear that the Afrikaner nationalist story is landing in Washington and, increasingly, within their own wider community. In mid-August, they broke ground on construction of a new Afrikaans language university outside Pretoria, one of the largest private sector investments in South Africa in years. But it represents more than just a university for Afrikaner nationalists. In effect, they're trying to build a parallel country. They base their new claims for self-determination in the failure of the Rainbow Nation to educate, protect, and provide for all communities. Many doubt that this segment of white people ever believed in non-racialism. But their criticisms about state dysfunction and economic regress are echoed across society. A sense of shared destiny is hard when half of young people can't find work, or when only a fraction of the roughly 70 homicides recorded each day, countrywide, ever results in a conviction. Over time, this gap between promise and reality has bred deep cynicism and eroded trust in the story. That it has not died owes much to the document that codifies the story, South Africa's Constitution. South Africans can organize as they wish, confront their leaders publicly, and hold them accountable. No country in Africa has a freer press. South Africa's constitution is transformational, explicitly allowing, quote, legislative and other measures, end quote, to protect or advance groups that have faced discrimination, essentially a protection of affirmative action. It is a profoundly liberal tract. This fact has always sat uneasy with how South Africa projects itself in the world. Officially, South Africa maintains a non-aligned foreign policy. The values enshrined in its constitution are said to be its fulcrum. Mr. Mandela famously wrote in a 1993 Foreign Affairs article that, quote, human rights will be the light that guides our foreign affairs, end quote, and that, quote, only true democracy can guarantee rights, end quote. South Africa's avid support for a Palestinian state is frequently cited as evidence. During Mr. Zuma's presidency, the African philosophy of Ubuntu, or I am, because we are, was introduced in policy documents to provide an, quote, African, end quote, basis for the country's foreign policy approach. It placed strong emphasis on pan-Africanism and solidarity with other countries in what it sometimes called the Global South, affirming a shared humanity. In practice, South Africa's diplomacy is hobbled by contradictions and incoherence. Its anti-Western rhetoric, fealty to Moscow, and strong alignment with China suggests that the Constitution does not amply inform Pretoria's worldwide. But neither does Ubuntu. It has gained some traction as a nation-branding exercise. Yet for all its lofty idealism, Ubuntu is a fuzzy concept, erratically applied, and mostly divorced from lived reality in large parts of society, where xenophobia against migrants is a deeply entrenched phenomenon. It is no wonder that defining South Africa's identity increasingly feels as if one is operating in an ideological war zone, torn between liberalism and statism, Ubuntu and tribalism. Quote, we seem most comfortable in the trenches, observes Kalim Rajab, chair of one of the country's leading democracy and human rights organizations. Quote, perversely, it is the place our aspirations in the early 90s sought to transcend, end quote. He points to South African, quote, tenacity, end quote, as the dominant motif of the past 15 years rather than a coalescing rainbow nation. Frustratingly, he adds, quote, while it is a theme at which we excel, tenacity is hardly a long-term strategy, end quote. South Africans also excel at what are despairingly known as, quote, talk shops, end quote, shorthand for frequent seminars or conferences in which the nation's myriad problems are laid bare. Yet many believe these gatherings do nothing to increase state capacity, grow the economy, or, since the TRC, promote shared understanding of their painful and tangled past. These efforts could become more meaningful if, heeding the advice of U.S. conservative intellectual Wilfred McClay, their organizers don't try, quote, to edit out those foundational stories, strange moral complexity, because it is there for a reason, he says. Quote, it is precisely our encounter with the surprise of their strangeness that reminds us of how much we have yet to learn from them, end quote. Few things are stranger and more charged than South Africa's nuclear past. It is the only country to ever build and then voluntarily give up its nuclear arsenal. The weapons could have derailed the democratic transition had they not been secretly destroyed in 1991 under Mr. de Klerk's orders. This chapter in South Africa's recent history holds vital lessons for curbing proliferation threats around the world. Yet the story is almost completely unknown within South Africa. In my own research on the subject, I have been struck by current officials' bald indifference to what they dismiss, sotto voce, as, quote, a white story, end quote. One person, sure to try to prevent the national dialogue from becoming another talk shop, is Saya Kolisi, a member of the dialogue's, quote, eminent persons group, end quote. Mr. Kolisi is the first black captain of South Africa's national rugby squad, the Springboks, the reigning world champions. The Springboks were an icon of white supremacy and brutality during apartheid. Since then, the racially transformed team has become the most salient reference point for the country's better angels, a visceral sign of the rainbow nation ideal. Mr. Kolisi often stresses the importance of national unity in his post-match interviews. The team's green jersey is worn by South Africans of all races on game days. Today, white South Africans represent roughly 7% of the total population, about half the proportion they had in 1990. Black South Africans make up about 82%. Despite demographic changes, polling confirms that most South Africans believe that progress depends on all races working together. Ah, la the Springboks. But that spirit will eventually fossilize if it can't find expression beyond rugby. A small but growing band of civic groups is trying to rebuild a sense of a shared future. Its pleas for active citizenship include campaigns pushing for constitutional accountability and anti-corruption reform. Of particular note is the, quote, fix it ourselves, end quote, ethos emerging in local community networks. Mr. Ngobeni, the spokesperson for Action SA, suggests that, quote, this ethos has the potential to be reframed as a national story of resilience and agency. If it can be scaled, coordinated, and connected to a vision that cuts across race, class, and geography, end quote. Internationally, the task of rebuilding is no less daunting. Once an icon of the liberal international order, South Africa is now portrayed by many U.S. lawmakers as a pariah. In the face of Washington's growing antipathy, the South African government has looked increasingly exposed. The vast store of political capital it built up in the West could have provided some diplomatic cover during these tensions, but that has mostly dried up. Most Western nations supported the ANC during apartheid and imposed sanctions on the white regime. Some helped establish new structures in the post-apartheid state and supported the drafting of its constitution. Their affinity for South Africa once ran deep despite policy differences. It doesn't anymore. Within the country, amid seemingly never-ending crises, people are desperate for a way to convey their attachment to and hope for their nation. Quote, I was effectively born into the Rainbow Nation, says Tabaso Masigo, head of a nonprofit focused on child welfare and education in Soweto, the township in Johannesburg that was at the heart of the anti-apartheid struggle. Quote, growing up in Soweto, we lived under the belief that change was coming for everyone. But no one in government really talks about it anymore. Their priorities changed. Everything became about business and making money for themselves and those connected to them. End quote. He laments that so few South Africans openly, quote, push the story now, end quote, but remains committed to, quote, trying to make the country work for everyone, end quote. Mr. Masego is part of one of the great political sagas of our time, the transition from apartheid to a free, non-racial society is as close to sacred as national stories can get. Since the turn of the century, the Rainbow Nation myth has been increasingly portrayed as irrelevant to the business of running South Africa and renewing its promise. Yet, as writer Steve Vizard sagely observed, powerful national myths like that, quote, don't get in the way of the operation of the nation. They are the operation of the nation, end quote. Leaders like Mr. Mandela and Mr. Tutu understood that. They grasped the unique power of South Africa's founding story to help it overcome the devastating legacies of the past. In trying to make the Rainbow Nation a reality, they changed their country for the better. Fact is, probably not lost on the determined South Africans trying to reboot the fragile nation-building project. They can draw on a rich tradition of national resilience and a defiance of the odds. Their success would be a win for humanity. And under commentary, Trump's peace tactics in Sudan. As more nations protest civilian massacres in Africa's third largest nation, a U.S.-led drive for humanitarian truce takes shape, upholding a norm of protecting the innocent during wars. By the Monitor's editorial board, there's a photo with the caption, displaced children from El Fasher, Sudan, play at a camp where they sought refuge from fighting November 3rd. In his self-portrayal as a global peacemaker, President Donald Trump prefers to employ arm-twisting pressure to stop a conflict such as in Gaza. Yet for one of the most intractable wars, a civil conflict in Africa's third largest country, Sudan, he might be relying on principled persuasion. The reason? Mass atrocities against civilians on both sides of that 18-month-long war have pushed many nations with a strategic stake in Sudan to join a Trump-led effort for humanitarian truce. On Monday, the U.S. Senior Advisor for Arab and African Affairs, Massad Boulos, said Sudan's rival military forces have agreed in principle to a 3-month truce, which would allow safe corridors for delivery of vital aid. If a pause in fighting does help the millions of Sudanese in need, it would be a nod to a global norm that recognizes the innocence of civilians in battle zones. And here's the overlooked benefit. If the two armies driving the conflict can agree to allow access for aid, the initial goodwill can be a toehold of trust for more difficult talks on a political peace. Quote, Sudan's tragedy is not inevitable, wrote Madani El-Shibli, executive director of the Cognizance Center for Strategic Studies in the Sudan Tribune. If a truce is well enforced, monitored, and financed, he added, it can turn the battlefield into a bridge toward peace. A due respect for the protection of civilians is not the only force at work. Many Sudanese participated in a 2019 pro-democracy uprising that felled a dictator. After the military ended that dream and then split into two warring factions, civilian activists have kept alive a popular desire for a sustainable democratic transformation. But first, Sudan needs a softening of hearts after frequent massacres of civilians. The latest massacre, which occurred in late October in El Fasher, the capital of North Darfur, was even denounced by the leader of the rapid support forces that were accused of the atrocity. Mohamed Hamdan, quote, Hamedi, end quote, Dagalo, promised that any soldier who committed a crime would be held accountable. He also told his troops, quote, do not harm civilians. Do not attack their property, their land, or their honor, end quote. If he means it, the United States-led peace plan has a future. And also on the commentary page, faith, not Trump's guns, can fix Nigerian violence. The U.S. president, claiming widespread persecution of Christians in Africa's most populous country, seeks a military solution. Yet even as West Africa generally confronts Islamic extremism, nations like Nigeria are finding an answer in religious interaction and respect. By the Monitor's editorial board, there's a photo with the caption, Muslims celebrating the end of Ramadan in Kaduna, Nigeria, April 2024. Asserting that Christians in Nigeria face an, quote, existential threat, end quote, President Donald Trump signaled over the weekend that the United States military might go into Africa's most populous country with, quote, guns ablazing, end quote. While his depiction of the situation is highly simplified, it could at least draw attention to the political and economic issues that have driven extremist insurgencies in Nigeria, as well as in nearby nations. One issue is that the violence committed by militant groups, many of which operate in the name of Islam, has hit people of different faiths. Quote, terror groups, dot, 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 have attacked mosques and churches alike, killing both imams and pastors, Muslims and Christians, without distinction, noted The Punch, a Nigerian news daily. Quote, portraying these conflicts as a one-sided religious debate and advocacy ignores the broader socio-economic and environmental pressures, dot, 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 that drive violence, end quote. Across West Africa, unstable governments have allowed insurgencies and apolitical, quote, banditry, end quote, to take hold. In addition, the climate crisis has sparked clashes between settled agrarian villagers, often Christian, and itinerant herders, mainly Muslim. And economies have not matched growth in population or expectations. Just last week, the Wall Street Journal reported that mineral-rich Mali is, quote, on the brink, end quote, of a takeover by Al-Qaeda-affiliated militants. Neighboring Niger and Chad also face insurgencies linked to Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State. Military efforts by these countries to root out extremism have had limited success. Civilian casualties caused by national armies spur resentment and seed recruitment by extremists. What's needed is a, quote, soft power approach that incorporates political, social, and even religious strategies, end quote, according to Nigerian researcher David Villa Dan Azumi, who has urged engaging with, quote, traditional and religious leaders, already instrumental in conflict mediation, intelligence gathering, and intercommunal dialogue, end quote. In fact, Nigerians have long supported such efforts, both structured and spontaneous. Kaduna State, centrally located amid the unrest, offers examples. A group of Muslim residents took up a community collection to pay ransom for Christians who had been kidnapped by a Sunday church from a Sunday church service in 2023. Previously, Muslims had guarded a church during a Christmas carol service. Guided by Johanna Baru, who heads the Peace Revival and Reconciliation Foundation, Kaduna's Christians distribute food to poor Muslims during Ramadan. In 2023, militants attacked Christian communities and Muslim places of worship. But in 2024, according to the Kaduna State Peace Commission, there were no recorded conflicts. Quote, I dedicate my life to preaching calm, peace, and unity in the region, Pastor Buru stated last year. This approach builds communication and trust that can transform viewpoints and possibilities. Quote, my perception changed, said university student Joseph Uloko, who participated in interfaith workshops in Kaduna some years ago. By understanding and respecting each other's traditions, he said, we, quote, let peace reign, end quote. Focusing on the right answers, by Catherine Dunton on the Christian Science Perspective page. The students attempted to solve a math problem was riddled with mistakes. Instead of getting caught up in the errors, we just erased the work and started over, making sure that each step was in accord with the laws of mathematics. So it is with Christian Science practice. Rather than focusing on and reacting to errors in thought, we start with spiritual ideas from God, truth, statements from the Bible, and the writings of Mary Baker Eddy, the discoverer of Christian Science, help us redirect our focus. Statements such as, quote, the Christ-like understanding of scientific being and divine healing includes a perfect principle and idea, perfect God and perfect man as the basis of thought and demonstration, end quote, from Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, page 259. And, quote, perfection underlies reality, end quote, Science and Health, page 353. Just as errors in trying to solve a math problem do not demonstrate the rules of mathematics, errors in human consciousness, sin, sickness, and death, do not express the grandeur and perfection of the divine principle, God. We must embrace the facts of spiritual being in order to erase mistaken materialistic views of God in thought. When confronted with inharmony of any sort, we can turn to prayer, recognizing that God, love, is the only power in the universe. As we pray to feel God's love for us and for everyone, we will be led to methodically challenge erroneous concepts in our thinking with the truth by starting with God's omnipotence. These mistaken beliefs become less intimidating and appear less real to us until they disappear. Jesus understood the necessity of turning away from a material picture to focus on God's allness. Mrs. Eddy writes, quote, Jesus beheld in science the perfect man who appeared to him where sinning mortal man appears to mortals. In this perfect man, the Savior saw God's own likeness, and this correct view of man healed the sick. From Science and Health, page 476 to 477. Today, as I confront the chaos that a material perspective presents to us, I follow Jesus' example. Instead of starting my day reading news headlines, I begin my day by communing with God. I pray to feel God's presence in my life and in the world. I know that all government is on God's shoulder and that God is omnipotent and in control. As we behold the perfect world of God's creating, This correct view heals the challenges we face and helps thought move forward toward solutions more widely, too. Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor, read by Melissa Bonnet.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.